Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I am very lucky today to be joined by Wall Street Journal reporter and new book author, Josh Mitchell. Josh, welcome to the show.
Sure, thanks. I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
So could you tell me how you got involved in reporting in the higher education space and what drew you to such a minefield?
So in 2012, I had just started as an economics reporter, and the editor that I was working for at the time assigned me to write about this report that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau had just put out that said student debt had crossed $1 trillion. So I wrote this story, and it got a lot of clicks. There were a lot of people who were really eager to read about why student debt was rising. I wrote a follow-up story, and the more I wrote about it, the more I saw that this was really affecting a lot of people, and that it was affecting them in ways that they were very angry. They were very passionate about their student loans. There were a lot of people who wrote me who felt like they didn't know what they were getting themselves into when they signed up for the loans. And so I saw right away that there was some dysfunction in the system. And the more I unraveled things, just the more interesting this topic got for me. So I've been covering it for 10 years now, and I learn something new every week.
Yeah, so I just applied for a mortgage, and I got this unbelievable stack of materials, of disclosures, telling me this is how much I'm going to pay in interest, this is how much I'm going to pay in fees. They itemized all of the fees. The disclosures were just unbelievable. And everybody I applied for a mortgage with, I got all these things in the mail telling me my credit score, and it was really quite overwhelming. What kind of disclosures are mandated to students when they sign up for, say, an expensive graduate degree program and they're deciding to take out these loans? What kind of regulations or disclosures are required to be told to students when they're taking the debt out?
So there aren't much. And that is one of the most interesting aspects of taking out a student loan. It's unlike just about any other credit product out there. First of all, the system itself is very opaque. So when you sign up for a student loan, it's not always apparent what the interest rate is or what the interest rate is going to be 4 years later when you're taking out your loans for your senior year. So you enter as a freshman, and basically the financial aid office, it says, here's your financial aid award, which is basically just sums up how many loans and grants you'll have access to cover the tuition at the school. But they don't say how much you'll owe by the end of 4 years. What ends up happening is there's this really incremental accrual of loans. You take out sometimes three or four loans a year, sometimes more than that. It's not really clear which loans are covering which costs. And then year two, your sophomore year, the school raises tuition 4%, 5%. The interest rate might change depending on whatever law Congress passed. And then year three, tuition goes up and the interest rate may have gone up. And so unlike a mortgage where you're told everything all at once, this is how much you owe, this is how much an interest you're going to pay at the end of the day, this is how long the repayment period is going to be. And not only that, the mortgage lender has to assess the value of the home that you're buying to make sure that the loan you're taking out isn't out of whack with the value of the actual asset. There's not really such an assessment when it comes to college. And so one of the things that I've discovered over and over and over again is that the loans are very often way more expensive than what the students are going to be able to repay. It's way higher than the actual value of the product that they're getting, but they don't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating. I mean, so to what extent do you feel like the undergrad student debt is obviously a big problem, but I really see the biggest tuition inflation at the graduate level where people can take out unlimited amounts. What risk to the system do you think each problem presents? So you can kind of have the undergraduate student problem and the acceleration of those costs, and then the proliferation of graduate degrees and the unlimited borrowing with that. So you talk about how this is a national catastrophe. What risk do you think is bigger to the overall economy? Is it the undergrad problem or the graduate school problem?
So there's been a shift just in the past couple of years. Now graduate school debt, I wouldn't say almost as much, but it's one of the biggest drivers of growth in all of student debt. Undergraduate debt used to be mainly what student debt was. In recent years, it's now more and more becoming graduate school debt. One of the reasons why is because the education department actually limits how much you can borrow as an undergraduate. There's a cap. There is not a cap on graduate students. And so, yes, that's where a lot of the growth is. I think overall, about 40% roughly of all student debt, $1.6 trillion, About 40% of that is graduate debt. But as you likely know, there's this program called Parent Plus, which allows parents to borrow anything on top of what their children borrow to cover college. So there's two things going on right now that I think are the biggest drivers of overall student debt. Parents who are borrowing on behalf of their children to go to college, that's growing by a lot. And then graduate students taking out debt to go to graduate school. And that includes law school, that includes med school. Those two things are very big.
Obviously, you could write a whole book about this because you did. But in terms, and by the way, the book, we'll talk about it at the end, but the book is called Debt Trap, How Student Loans Became a National Catastrophe. And I want to say that's coming out August 3rd. Simon & Schuster's the publishers. We'll say that again later. But you talk about a summary of how the problem originated. So you talk about Sputnik and it started from there. Can you give maybe a 30 second to a minute sort of description of the entire timeline of student loan debt in America in the past 70 years?
Sure. Actually, I would say the proper starting point is the GI Bill. So you have all of these soldiers coming home from World War II. And this was like an experiment by FDR to figure out, what do we do with these 20 million people who are coming home all at once? I think it was about 20 million. Don't quote me on that. But there were a lot of people coming home all at once. And there was this concern that if they entered the workforce all at once, that employers would not be able to hire them quickly enough. Let's do something to give employers time to hire them. Oh, let's put them into college. And this actually was a really big deal because up until then, a lot of people couldn't afford college. So you had this surge in people going to college right after World War II. And then when they left, there was this big question, okay, so what happens now? We have this experiment essentially with free college. What about people after that surge who want to go to college? How do we finance that? And so there was this big fight, which is what we currently have. It was happening back then, which is, okay, do taxpayers cover college at large, or do we have students themselves pay for college? And that debate never got resolved until Sputnik. Sputnik happens, which is basically where the Soviet Union in 1957 launched a satellite into space. And this really was a big wake-up call for particularly Lyndon Johnson. He was the Senate Majority Leader at the time. He had his eye on the White House. And there was this big wake-up call where, as a country, we were concerned that the Soviet Union was winning the space race. And that a big reason why was because they had a lot of scientists and engineers. They had been investing in science education. And so in response to Sputnik, less than a year later, Congress created the first student loan program. And the goal was very tailored at this point. It was to increase the ranks of scientists and engineers in the United States so that we can reclaim the space race. Less than, let's see, about 7 years later, Lyndon Johnson, when he's in the White House, he actually turned that narrow goal into a broad social mission, which was, let's give everyone access to college. I think he was the first president who said higher education is now a necessity, not a choice. And he viewed this as a way to level inequality. He was a teacher himself. And so the program very quickly went from a quick response to Sputnik and with this narrow goal of increasing the ranks of scientists to all of a sudden being this broad social mission where higher education was going to help solve this big societal ill. There were a lot of poor people and income inequality. He thought that it could do that. And it just grew from there.
When they made these programs about income-based repayment and PSLF in like the late 2000s, I know this was before you were officially covering the beat, but because this is really a bipartisan thing that they did at the time, was Congress naive? Did Congress know what it was doing? What would your impression be in terms of when these lawmakers wrote these rules? They were well-intentioned, but they certainly created a lot of unique problems. Do you think that they anticipated any of those?
That was one of the things I discovered in writing this book, is that members of Congress have wanted everyone to have access to higher education, at least since the 1960s. And for-profit colleges have often filled in the gap when public colleges couldn't expand capacity quickly enough to take in those students. Just as an example, there was a for-profit college crisis just after the Vietnam War. There was actually one right after the GI Bill. A lot of for-profit schools propped up after the initial GI Bill and saw this as a great money-making opportunity. Same thing happened when Vietnam veterans were coming back from the war, and there were a lot of for-profit schools that cropped up then. There was a for-profit college crisis in the 80s, and then it completely blew up in the 2000s with Wall Street getting involved, and these for-profit schools grew. So Congress has ignored red flags when problems have arose because they want to maintain this mandate to give everyone access to the school of their choice.
That makes a lot of sense. And if you look at dental school in the 1960s and 70s, it was primarily a white male institution. If you look at dental school today, it's extremely diverse. I'm not sure about the gender split, but I think it's pretty close to half and half. There's a lot of representation of Asian Americans, African Americans, Hispanic Americans that you didn't have 50 years ago. And you can make an argument that student loans and the messed up system that we have is at least partly responsible for that positive development. So to what extent do you think that maybe the positive things that have happened from equity could maybe make the student loan system worthwhile? Would you say that maybe the student loan system should just be more grant-based? Or do you think the student loan system is having some positive effects on equity, but negative effects on people's finances? I mean, what do you think is the right balance between equity and a system that's not so screwed up?
I think that's a great point, that student loans have, in one way, achieved its goal, which is to broaden access to higher education, to allow more and more people to cover tuition who otherwise wouldn't be able to. So they have achieved that goal, but it has come at the expense, making the system very costly. In this sense, I compare it to healthcare. Our nation's healthcare system gets a bad rap, obviously, because it's so expensive. And yet we do have some of the best hospitals in the world. And so there's, you know, two sides of the coin. I think higher education is sort of the same. It's a very expensive system, in part because easy access to loans has enabled schools to raise their prices higher than they otherwise would have. To answer your question about how to fix it or what needs to happen, one of the things I discovered is there was actually a student loan program before the federal student loan program, and the default rates were extremely low, and tuition was relatively in check back then. And so the question is, why was that student loan program so effective at achieving its goals without these other problems compared to our current student loan program? And one of the things I discovered was the first student loan program, which was called United States Aid Funds, USAF, was actually a program that required schools to put up their own money. So this was like basically an insurance fund where schools and private corporations and banks would throw money into a pot. That money would reimburse lenders when students took out loans. And if the student failed to repay the loans, schools were on the hook for some of the money. And so the risk of losing money, I think, made schools very reluctant to give loan amounts that were too high to be repaid by students. And so schools had more skin in the game than they do now. When I describe this, I think about the fact that if you look at where lawmakers on different ends of the spectrum stand on what to do about the system, there is a bipartisan consensus that there needs to be more discipline built into the system for schools to have more skin in the game. And the question is, how do you achieve that? And that's something that Congress has looked at in recent years. They haven't really come to a conclusion on how to do that. But I think that there is this broad principle that lawmakers on both sides agree with, which is that schools need more skin in the game.
Here's a real question is, how do you untangle the Gordian knot? So just an example, if you've got an NYU dental student who's taken out $700,000 of dental school debt to get a four-year dental education, the school has scaled up its budgetary expenses to make sure that all of the expenses are well spent, or all the revenue is well spent. And to change the system to put skin in the game for these schools would be so disruptive to these programs, where they might have to cut half of the seats in their student body. So I guess this is kind of a two-part question. I guess one is, it is a catastrophe, I think, but is it like a Social Security Medicare catastrophe, where it's just an unfunded liability where it just grows and grows and they just constantly kick the can down the road? Or do you foresee some sort of highly disruptive event like a graduate schools across the country being squeezed by new rules that does lead to half the classes of these dental schools, for example, being cut off, or some sort of major disruption like physicians losing PSLF at some point that causes a mass number of people to not go to medical school in a given year? What kind of catastrophic things might happen with this system that we have as it's currently designed?
I think this is more of a case of the frog boiling in the pot, but not knowing it's dying. I get asked that question all the time. When is the financial crisis going to happen that's going to lead to the economy crashing? People's reference point is 2008. And I always say it's not going to look like 2008. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's already happening. You just don't quite see it. For example, there's something like 8 million people who have defaulted on their loans. That's not too far off from the number of people who had their homes foreclosed upon at after the housing crisis. So there's a lot of people who have defaulted. As you know, defaults are people who owe relatively small amounts of student debt because a lot of those people are dropouts who went to community colleges, for-profit colleges, and what have you. But aside from defaults, you have people who are carrying $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and then they can't keep up with the monthly payments. So they go into income-based repayment, which keeps them from defaulting on their loans in a given month, but it means that they're making payments for 25 years and 30 years out. And so one of the characters that I wrote about, she was a single mom taking care of two kids, and she was staying current on her loans, but she was making no progress toward paying off the principal. And so the balance was rising and rising. She had to take forbearance because there was a personal crisis that happened. A tree fell on her house and she split from her husband, and there were life events that happened that prevented her from making payments for a year. So she goes into forbearance, the balance rises. And I say this because a lot of people will say, okay, well, like, how is that a crisis per se for the economy? And at the end of the day, she's in her 50s. She still owes $100,000 18 years later, and she's saved up barely anything for her to retire. And she didn't have any money saved up for her kids to go to college. So it's hard to see how individual cases like that affect the economy at large. But I think in the aggregate, if you think about it, you have a lot of money that people are devoting toward paying interests or paying off high levels of tuition that is not going toward down payments for houses or their own children's college education or their own retirement income. And those are things that are going to have a subtle but pernicious effect on the economy. It's just not going to be a crash. That, I think, is one of the biggest impacts.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's sort of just the disruptive effects of if the system does change. Let's say that people finally realize the frog's boiled and you say, okay, now we really got to change the system. And so say, for example, in the PROSPER Act, when the House Republicans in 2017 were considering that, they were going to have a date by which basically PSLF was over for anybody who started school on or after that date. I'm just curious if that would lead to way more people deciding not to go to medical school or whatever graduate program, say the rules were way more generous on this date or before and way less generous on this date or after, what kind of major disruptions that you might have in higher education. I would imagine there'd be a lot, but we just can't predict the future.
Let me answer this with a story, because a lot of times I try to answer these big picture questions by talking to the people who are most involved in higher education, particularly the presidents of colleges. One of the guys I interviewed, his name is Stephen Joel Trachtenberg. He's been written about in prior books. He was the president of George Washington University in DC in the 1980s through early 2000s. And the reason why I interviewed him is because he has this reputation as being the priest of runaway tuition. I think that was a headline that appeared in Slate. Don't quote me on that. But basically, he was a pioneer in this concept of, you know, you raise tuition as high as you can, and students will still pay for it because they think the higher the tuition is, the higher quality the school. I asked him why he was raising prices so quickly. He said because he wanted to invest in his campus. He wanted to provide the highest quality education that's expensive. He said, however, on the flip side, he also recognized that college and graduate school, higher education, is a very inefficient system if you're looking at it from an industry perspective. He said, what industry operates 4 days a week, 9 months of the year? In other words, there's a lot of capacity underutilization. And he said 4 days a week because Friday is where a lot of professors take off. A lot of students go out on Thursday night. They take maybe one class on Fridays. And so essentially, you're operating only 4 days of the week as a business, and then 9 months of the year for the most part. And so he said he recognized that his school could be way more efficient if they operated 7 days a week and 12 months of the year. And maybe students could leave within 3 years rather than four, and that would save them money and everything would be more efficient. And so he had this proposal to move to a 7 day a week, 12 month a year academic year. And very quickly, professors overruled him and the faculty senate killed the proposal without even bringing it up for a vote. And when you say, would schools be forced to close? Would there be this like big crash in higher education? Maybe. Or the other possibility is they'll be forced to become more efficient after resisting years and years of doing so.
So do you see it as a reporter, people lobbying effectively and getting everything that they want with the student loan system? So one example that comes to mind is it seems like the American Medical Association or people advocating on behalf of physicians did a really excellent job the last time the rules were written, getting residencies and getting that just broad physician employment for the most part included in the definition of what would count for a public service eligible job. Whereas other people that are involved in public service, such as dentists or veterinarians, got excluded from that definition. What kind of things do you think that we will see in the future with lobbying for certain kinds of higher education policies that favor one group over another?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've come to see the student loan program as just like the tax code. It becomes an opportunity for all these interest groups to lobby for their own carve-outs. And public service loan forgiveness, for example, the original intent was to incentivize people to become public defenders in these rural areas that couldn't draw lawyers because no one wanted to live in a rural area and they wanted to go to these big law firms. So let's pay off their student debts so that they would move to these areas that really needed public defenders. And instead, the way that they wrote the law, it now applies to basically any nonprofit worker anywhere. That includes Johns Hopkins in a really urban area, which pays their employees well. And so, yes, there are a lot of interests at play here. And this is one of the arguments in my book, is that if you look at how the system plays out, it actually, in a lot of ways, increases inequality. In some ways, there are a lot of people who are well off who are having their debts forgiven. And then in other ways, you have some of the poorest students and poorest families who are being charged a lot of interest, who don't have access to programs like public service loan forgiveness. And you take a look at who gets what, and a lot of times it's arbitrary. And I think that as the program gets bigger and bigger, and it becomes more of an opportunity for different interest groups to try and carve out loopholes.
So one question I've got for you, going back to your earlier example that you do in your book of the single mom in her 50s with the six figures of student debt. So one thing that a group like ours might suggest to her is if you maximize your retirement contributions and your 401k contributions, you can get your taxable income very low. And now your payments will be $100 or $200 a month. And we'll suggest that you delay Social Security until 70 and just retire and spend down all of your retirement assets until 70 to claim that Social Security so that your payments will continue to be $100 to $200 a month. And then 25 years in, you will likely be insolvent and that debt will be forgiven tax-free. So essentially, she's getting her debt canceled just in slow motion. So I guess what would be the difference between canceling debt up front for people like that who have no hope of paying it back versus that kind of a person working with a group like ours that's going to very efficiently get that payment down to a very small amount of money and transfer that cost onto the system anyway? Like, what is the difference between those two outcomes, do you think?
Well, first of all, it depends on if they know about groups like you and if they have access to that information. Now, I can tell you one of the reasons why I profiled her was because I was raised by a single mom of two kids. I have a twin. And so he and I were raised by a single mom. She was a secretary like the woman that I profile in my book. She didn't earn a lot. The woman I profile in my book was a secretary who went on to college and then graduate school to become a psychologist. And she took on $120,000 in debt. My mom never went to college, but she grew up in Eastern Pennsylvania, just like this woman. And when you're raised in a childhood like that by a mother like that, I saw up front that my mom just wasn't aware that there are people like you who could provide financial advice, who can help her make the proper decisions to benefit her financially in the long run. And so what ends up happening in the case of the woman that I profiled is she turns to Sallie Mae, her loan servicer, and said, look, I'm in a bind. A lot of things have happened that are preventing me from keeping up on my loans. What should I do? And they said, oh, go into forbearance. According to her, that's what they told her. And a year later, her balance had risen and she wasn't aware that it was going to rise. And all of a sudden, then it becomes like quicksand. And I don't think in a moment like that, they're thinking, oh, like, who's the financial advisor out there? Like, where's Travis Ordensby? What's his number? So I think a lot of people just don't have access to that information. There are people that do. Profiled an orthodontist who owes a lot of money, actually $1 million in student loans for having gone to UFC dental school. And he contacted a financial advisor as he was in school to figure out what was the best policy to take advantage of to lower the amount that he would pay in the long run. So there are people who can do that. There are a lot of others, though, that are not aware of that and might not have access to those programs because of when they took out their loans. That's a whole other story. I'll stop there.
Just an example, I met a nice couple the other day where the wife was an elementary special education teacher. And she had, I think, maybe 40 or 50,000 of student loan debt, had been on the teacher loan forgiveness program instead of public service loan forgiveness and not getting credit for those two concurrently.
Yep.
And so that's something that, you know, to the extent that I have things that bother me about what we do, that's certainly something. Is who are the people that reach out to a group like ours? It's somebody who really sees the value, who has high education and high debt and sometimes high income, often high income, that realizes this is a no-brainer to optimize this to pay less. Whereas that person who is the single mom might have a lower income is not going to reach out. She's going to reach out to that loan servicer. And if those Sallie Mae loans were FFELP loans, obviously those, they're getting interest on those. And so the right answer is to consolidate them and leave that system. Yep. And then they lose the interest income. So of course they have a negative incentive to tell her what the best thing to do is.
Yes.
Is that, you know, so I guess one issue with the student debt cancellation is if you do it broadly, it's very expensive and it does benefit some people who have higher incomes. If you were to design some sort of student loan reform to help those people like those single moms out there that are probably not going to contact professionals for help, is there something that you think would be something that would not increase inequality? It would decrease inequality to help and reach down to some of those people who've really been screwed over by the system, especially the lower income people.
Yeah, this is a huge fight that's going on right now, even within the Democratic Party, not just between Democrats and Republicans, which is, would canceling student debt be progressive or regressive? Would it end up helping mostly well-off people, or would it help poor people or even middle-class people who really need a leg up? That is a never-ending debate. I think income-based repayment is an important concept to understand, because that's something that, if you look throughout history, basically, everyone who's paid close attention to student loans has gotten on board with this concept. This goes back to Milton Friedman. He wrote an essay in 1955, I want to say. All right. Have you heard of this essay that he wrote?
I have heard of it.
And so this was when the whole idea of a federal student loan program started to be discussed. This was several years before Sputnik, but he basically said, okay, yes, there is a role for the government to play in kickstarting the student loan market. However, be very careful about how you set the payments, because there is so much variation in how much college students will earn once they're out of college that if you just give someone a flat monthly payment, some people will be able to pay it off, but others won't, because some people might land a highly paid job in one profession and then others might not. And so you're going to have a lot of people defaulting. This is a concept that has been discussed throughout time, this idea that it's more efficient and it's safer from the student's perspective to set their monthly payments as a share of their income, so that whatever their income is, the monthly payments is always commensurate with that. But income-based repayment as a policy didn't really enter the law until the 1990s, as you mentioned. And even then, not a lot of people used it until around 2010 or so. And so I think there are a lot of people who say, look, income-based repayment makes a lot of sense, but the way it's currently designed, there's a lot of flaws with it. And that's what I think one of the big debates is right now, is how do you make income-based repayment more efficient and more effective from the student's perspective without encouraging schools to merely increase their prices more? And there's a lot of ideas on how to do that, but there isn't really a consensus.
Makes sense. I mean, they're doing the new negotiated rulemaking process now, which could potentially result in a new income-based repayment program. Mm-hmm. And with all of the benefits that people currently get from programs like pay and repay, interest subsidies, filing their taxes separately, it seems unlikely that the new program would wipe out all the old programs. So I don't know if you can share any insight, certainly things that are not confidential stories you're working on, but any kind of thoughts on what the next, say, year two of higher ed policy might look like? Do you think they make a new income-based program, or do you think they try to throw out the old ones, or any predictions?
It's hard to tell, because as President Biden is still saying he's open to the idea of canceling at least some student debt, whether that's $10,000 or more. And so his administration says that they're still looking at that. And it's hard to tell what they're going to do with policy until the administration or Congress decides on canceling student debt. I wrote a story recently, and I think that this will become a bigger issue as policymakers decide what to do over the long term. But it really is becoming a big cost from a taxpayer's perspective. if you just look at how much money the program is costing on paper, it's growing. And so I think that the impetus for longer term reforms will grow as those costs grow. And if you simply expand access to student loan forgiveness without addressing the underlying drivers of cost increases, the problem will likely get worse, at least from a taxpayer's perspective. And this is the danger of where it could look more and more like healthcare. I compare proposals of student loan forgiveness to the healthcare discussions that were happening in 2008. It was the same thing where you had households that were increasingly being impacted by higher healthcare costs. And the big debate within the Obama administration at the time was, do we increase insurance to defray the cost to households, or do we do something that creates more systemic reform to really bring the cost of medical care under control? Those were sort of two competing things. And they went with basically providing more insurance, but not doing as much as some people wanted within the Obama administration about how to do the underlying cost drivers. And I think that's a similar debate that's facing the Biden administration right now, which is, do you help borrowers now by canceling their debt? Or do you do things that over the longer term will really bring the cost drivers under control? And the focus has been right now on canceling debt. But the big question is, okay, you cancel debt now. What happens to people who take out loans next fall? So it's hard to tell where things are going to be headed. The rulemaking hasn't started yet. But I would imagine that these bigger, more existential issues are coming to the fore.
Just sitting here, just like watching a train wreck in slow motion, right? The Fed Loan Servicing recently came out and said it's not interested in expanding its contract past December 2021. Who knows if that's just a negotiating ploy to maybe extract a massive payment out of Department of Ed because they have so much leverage. But in the short run, what the heck happens with student loan servicing, right? Because if you have Fed Loan go away, the only other group that I can think of that could take over that job in a hurry would be maybe Mohela, because they use the same Compass payment software, and AES, which is a subsidiary of the group that owns Fed Loan, is the backup servicer to Mohela. And if you look at the ratings that consumers give Mohela, the ratings are also pretty poor. And you're starting repayments again for 42 million people. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of train wreck do you foresee the next year or two being with student loan policy in terms of the student loan borrower?
It depends on how you define train wreck. From the students' perspective, they're in a good spot right now because a lot of people with student loans have gone almost a year and a half without making payments. They may get another 3 months. So we're now talking about almost 2 years of no payments and interest being waived on those loans. So from households' perspective, this pandemic has helped a lot of households get a leg up on their student loans based on what Congress passed. Now, I think the tricky part is, how does the government turn that system back on? The servicers are obviously a big part of that. It's tricky because if you talk to a lot of people who are close to the servicing industry, they will say that the government is really trying to do this on the cheap, and that if they really want to help the servicers do a more effective job, the government's going to have to pay them more. At the same time, the servicers haven't really had to do anything for the past year and a half because they haven't had to get anyone's payments. So you do wonder, where is all the money that the government's been paying them? Where is that going to over the past year and a half? So I do think that there could be a mess if the government tries to restart these loans, particularly with a lot of people having moved. I don't know about you, but like a lot of my friends have moved around from state to state during this pandemic. And so it might be hard to reach them. But the servicer issue, I've always thought, was like a symptom of a broader ill. And I think there are real problems in the servicing industry. I lay them out in my book, but you could have the best servicers in the world, and I think you're still going to have some underlying issues because, again, the servicers aren't the ones who are awarding $180,000 in student debt for a master's degree recipient at Columbia University who goes on to earn $30,000. Like, how does a good servicer help that person?
Yeah, that's a great question that I don't have the answer to. So the last question I've got for you is, tell us what your book is and where people can go buy it and when.
The book is called The Debt Trap. It's out August 3rd. And one thing I want to say about it is that I try to tell this story through characters. So this is not a dry, dense book. There are a lot of interesting characters involved. I interview everyone from the Sallie Mae CEOs who were leading the company to massive growth, to members of Congress, to four people who took on a lot of student loans. One student went to the University of Alabama, really big state flagship. Another student went to a, you know, a private college. I interview a for-profit college student. So this covers a lot of ground, and it's just the characters themselves are really interesting and I think really tell this story well. Out August 3rd, and you can choose which outlet you want to buy it from, whether it's Amazon or your local bookstore, but it's bit.ly, so bit.ly/debttrapbook, bit.ly/debttrapbook. And I'd be really excited for you to buy it.
Awesome. Well, Josh Mitchell, author of The Debt Trap and journalist for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being on our show.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.